Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to BYT Radio. My name is Brandon Weatherby. BYT Radio stands for Brightest Young Things Radio. Brightest Young Things is an arts and culture website based out of Washington, D.C., with a presence in New York and Chicago. And we also throw events. We recently kicked off Pride last Friday. You can view those photos on brightestyoungthings.com. And next week, we'll be announcing details for the third Death Becomes Us Festival, which will take place in Washington, D.C. in November 2019. And that is the premise for the first 30 minutes of this show. BYT's Death Becomes Us Festival director, Jen Tisdale, joins the show to do a little bit of a preview of what's going to happen in November, but more importantly, a little recap of what happened at my favorite show of the most recent Death Becomes Us Festival, which was in March of 2019 in New York City. And so in addition to hearing Jen Tisdale and I, you'll also hear the voices of Damien Eccles, Amanda Knox, and John Douglas. Now, when you hear those voices, it will be very clear who is speaking, because Amanda does not sound like Jen, Damien, and John, and I do not sound alike. So John Douglas is the FBI profiler. You know him as the the man behind Mindhunter. He wrote that book. Incredibly important human individual. Damien Eccles, unfortunately, part of the West Memphis Three, wrongfully convicted, was on death row. You'll hear his voice. And similar situation with Amanda Knox, another wrongfully convicted individual. It was a really, really fascinating show last March, and I'm glad that we're going to hear very, very, very small snippets from that show throughout this episode. So that's the first part of the show. The second part of the show is a chat with Nina O'Neill, who is head of the Monochrome Collective, and they're collaborating with By the People, and their pop-up opens this Saturday. So not exactly the same thing as true crime. She's highlighting 51 DMV-based artists in a very gorgeous space for the next few weeks in Georgetown. But I think it's interesting, and I'm really glad that we have this show. So here's the first part. It's with Jen Tisdale and I, with some clips from Damien Eccles, Amanda Knox, and John Douglas from Death Becomes Us Festival.
Why is there a third Death Becomes Us Festival coming?
Because there's always death coming. I mean, we're never going to run out of, sadly,
that's unfortunate,
true crime. That is unfortunate. And hopefully I'm never going to run out of ways to make it less depressing.
Yeah, you made it
Made true crime fun again?
You made it not as depressing as I thought. My favorite show from the November edition was inherently the saddest. It was the Damien Eccles, Amanda Knox, John
Douglas. The March edition.
From the March edition in New York City.
Yeah.
That was my favorite show, and that was not a fun show. That was not like your wine and crimes. It took things seriously,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you do well with the festival, is you're able to do stuff that's like super serious, like here are two wrongly convicted people that lost lots of years of their life, one of which was like on death row. This is very
most
scary stuff.
Most of the time, yeah.
To like, here's a fun episode of Dateline, let's riff about it type of stuff.
Well, I think it helps. I got lucky because both Amanda Knox and Damien Eccles are pretty lighthearted and jokey now about
it. Sure.
So, you know, I mean, there were serious moments, of course, because it was, especially for Amanda, who is going back in, she's going back to Italy, actually, I think in a week or two.
Listener at home can't see, my eyes got bigger. I opened up my face a little bit more. Why?
Well, she's going back to speak at, and someone, I'm so sorry if I don't have this information on me,
it's
some sort of like conference about.
Okay, wrongfully that's like, convicted. That's
had
or the
some,
prison
yeah,
system.
So something to do with what happened to her.
Okay.
And she's speaking at this conference, and she's mentioned going back to Italy for the first time at our show, which was pretty, I hate to say special because it makes me sound like I'm capitalizing on her grief.
But it was pretty
special to hear her say that.
Actually, we're going to, if it's okay with you, I'm going to cut in some clips from that show.
Absolutely.
All right. So one of the things I liked about it was I'm never going to know, hopefully, fingers crossed, I'm never going to know what it feels like to be wrongfully convicted on death row.
I have a surprise for you. One of the shows coming up.
And seeing these people surviving and seeing these people doing the best with a very negative situation is somewhat inspiring and hopeful. And I didn't think there'd be a lot of hope in a festival called Death Becomes Us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do know that. And I also think a lot about how I would react. And I am deeply ashamed to admit that I don't think I would be
as calm as
anything like them. I mean, I fall apart when I stub my toe. So
do you actually think this is...
I mean, I've been to jail.
I don't need to know if you've watched the Amanda Knox doc or Paradise Lost or any of that. But I just want to say, from the outset, the reason why I don't need to know if you've watched it is because, number one, I don't want to throw you under the bus if you haven't. Number two,
I've watched them both.
I don't think it matters if you've seen this. But I just want to posit the question is, you and I think, and a lot of more people, are not as rational as Amanda Knox and Damien Eccles. I think we're a little bit more emotional. And I'm wondering if their intellect actually caused them more harm, because throughout both trials, throughout multiple trials, both of these individuals were like, I clearly didn't do this. What is going on? It'll be fine.
Yeah.
Where you just said you stubbed your toe, you're going to freak out. I think you'd be freaking out. I think I'd be freaking out. Like, what the hell is going on?
I think that, well, it's what's interesting is that they have such vastly different backgrounds, mm-hmm. and I've talked about this before, how I think Amanda, obviously existing in the digital internet age,
yeah.
versus Damien's,
for sure.
obviously, but also being a woman, she had a whole mess of other problems
yes.
that Damien didn't
yes.
have. Obviously, Foxy Noxy is, like, not, Damien didn't get a cute, like, nickname.
No, he did not get a cute nickname.
I never thought, never imagined that what happened to Meredith would happen, that what happened to me would happen. So I was extremely unprepared for anything like that. I wasn't like a true crime person. I didn't read mystery novels. Like I read comic books. So.
I think that Amanda having like a, I'm just going to say, I think she had a better home life, a better background.
That's debatable.
Yes. I think that a lot of her faith was just in this idea that she's never come across any issues before. And you just have a certain faith in the judicial system when you've never had any problems.
That's a very good point.
I think it was our case that made me realize, you know, once again, like John was saying at the beginning, how when you're a kid and the only exposure you have to the legal system and everything else is what you've seen on TV, then you believe that. You know, you believe that the vast majority of people who are involved in it are good guys, and that there's only like here and there like one or two bad people spread out through it. It was this case that made me realize the corruption inherent in, you know, not just the entire judicial system, but also the media in general, you know.
I think that it's interesting now because when you've always been interested in this. And when I say always, I mean since I've known you. Do you remember when you got into it? What year it was or how old you were? Because it was before the big trend. It was before where we are now.
What's fun? Okay, I have a notoriously bad memory,
mm-hmm.
Which is why Facebook memories are a blessing and a curse.
Oh, really?
Because I don't remember things and then I'll be like, oh, I guess I was posting about Jeffrey Dahmer. Huh. 5 or 6 years ago, but I think that, and I think I've told you this story before, but for me, having my little familial history with mm-hmm. the Derringer gun.
Sure. For the listener at home, or for the people that aren't me, what are you referring to?
My great-great-great, whatever many times it is, grandfather was a gunsmith.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something to be proud of nowadays. At some point, it was sort of an art.
Well, we could debate about that.
I would hate to do that. And he invented the Derringer pistol, which is the gun that John Wilkes Booth used to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. So, like, I've always had this knowledge.
Yeah.
It's not like we, like, sat around a fire at night and told spin yarns about it.
Understood.
But
it was
just always there, and I kind of always obviously was fascinated by that story, and then horror novels and movies, which a lot of people also talk about.
So I think it's fair to say, like, childhood.
Forever.
So you've always been interested
forever.
In this. And you mentioned something about how Amanda Knox didn't really have to deal with the legal system at all because, like, she's from a good family and
mm-hmm.
she never had to face these certain things. Or Damien kind of sort of had to face these things.
He had always been crucified.
Exactly.
For various reasons.
You know, people now make fun of people who live in trailer parks, you know, trailer trash. When we did move into a trailer park, we were moving up in the world. You know, had running water and electricity. It was like life suddenly got a lot better than it had ever been before. You know, if I told a lot of people about all the details of my life, you know, I dropped out of school in ninth grade. When I was born, my mother was 15, my dad was 16. You know, there were times when we moved every 2 weeks. You know, you add all this stuff together, and it sounds kind of horrible, but I didn't think it was horrible at the time. To me, it was like the life of everyone that I knew. You know, if we heard about something like, you know, people going to college or moving to New York or something, that had the same amount of realism to us as fairy tales. You know, that's not real. It's not something that you're actually ever going to come across, that you're actually ever going to meet, you know, people with college degrees or what have you. I didn't think it was terrible. I just thought it was life. But in a lot of ways, you know, looking back on everything that I went through when I was a kid, in hindsight, you know, just the poverty and everything else, I honestly don't think I would have survived almost 20 years in prison without it. You know, I can remember, the environment in there is beyond description. You know, there were times whenever the sewage would back up and you would find yourself standing in like ankle-deep raw sewage. And it may last for 12, 14 hours before they finally managed to clean it out. And there was a guy that I knew there, and this guy was completely and absolutely insane in every sense of the word. He was there because he had beat another man to death with a can of corn. You know, he had turned canned goods into a deadly weapon. And we're standing there in sewage, and this guy starts singing that Lynyrd Skynyrd song, "Can You Smell That Smell?" I looked up and I started laughing. You know, it was one of those things that I couldn't stop laughing, and I was laughing so hard my stomach was hurting. And I looked over at this other guy and I said, "You know, okay, I realize it's fucked up in here. You know, we're eating garbage, we're standing in ship water. But isn't there part of you sometimes that's still having fun?" And he looked at me and said, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" But I think if it wasn't for my childhood, I wouldn't have been able to survive.
It's interesting because in the last year, I don't think it's crazy to say that the popularity of true crime has skyrocketed, which is a weird thing to say. It's a weird thing to say. Let me get there. Hold on. And I think that now we've crossed over into it no longer just being, and I'm not trying to insult your crowd here, not just being white women that are interested in this. And I'm basing this on attending the November edition 2018 and the March 2019 edition. It's predominantly white women interested in this. Thanks to Kim Kardashian, she is now making it no longer a race-based issue in a wonderful way. She's interested in true crime for the wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
She's interested in true crime for the people.
Prison reform.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Super serious, heavy issues. I'm not saying these other issues aren't heavy, but now we're kind of taking race out of it. We're now acknowledging race, and I think it's a good thing.
So do I. It is something, I think about this a lot in terms of programming the festival and how it is, sadly, the programming is a little whitewashed, and I do think of that a lot. I'm trying to signal boost other less, I guess, splashy issues and splashy stories, and that, you know, I hopefully this time around we'll be working with the Innocence Project, and they are very good at reminding people that most of the people in prison are predominantly black and or marginalized in some way, and if you look at their page, they have the stories of everyone they've helped free, and it is mostly black men.
At the March edition of the Death Becomes Us, one of the episodes of a podcast was about the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah,
and I want to say that was the
they had
first
just reopened the case actually right before that.
And that was
show.
The first time it was not both the victim and or the criminal were not white people.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds messed up to talk about equality when it comes to murders and stuff like this, but it's kind of important. And I think it doesn't fetishize this as much, and it becomes less of a oddity. Look, how could this person do it? And more of a we as a society need to change and hold everyone to the same standard. And I'm kind of getting on a soapbox here.
No.
But
The reason why I bring this up is because you're next week, the end of this week, you're not even going to be in Washington, D.C. You're going to be in New Orleans.
I will be.
For a different true crime festival.
Yes, CrimeCon. Yeah.
CrimeCon, Death Becomes Us. There's a handful of these festivals now. And I think everyone's trying to ride this fine line between seriousness and frivolity. Do you find yourself struggling with that?
I do personally, because I have always had a deeply dark sense of humor. I have to bounce ideas, and you know this, I bounce them off you all the time. I need to ask people, am I being too callous? Am I not being sensitive enough? So I try to program the festival. It's like the three-prong attack, which is probably not a great word for this festival, is a serious show. A show that I turn into a true crime show by virtue of a true crime guest. So a non-traditional true crime show.
Could you give an example of that?
Of one that I already have or one we're going to announce?
Let's not announce anything right now.
Of course. Okay. So in March we did Tinder Live, which mm-hmm. is
it's a dating show.
It's a dating show. And the guests were Kat Timpf, a friend of mine, she's a Fox News person, Amanda Knox, and Paul Holes and Billy Jensen, a.k.a. The Murder Squad. So that has...
What a lineup. What a surreal show.
It was wild. I was actually nervous about asking Amanda, given her previous moniker, because I thought there's no way she's going to want to talk about dating, but she was so excited, because actually what she said to me was she likes doing these non-traditional things. It's good to get away from that and just have fun.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you're going to have some fun. So the serious show, the non-true crime show... turned into true crime show, and then hopefully a funny true crime. So like Last Podcast on the Left is the funny true crime show. So it's both. They're very good. They're the best, in my opinion, of towing the line between they're incredibly informative, incredibly sensitive. This isn't going to sound crazy, maybe, but they did it. I think it's a 2 or 3 part 9/11 episode that they are so... I cried. It was one of the most beautiful things. And then they're still funny at times because they punch...
You punch up.
I was trying to remember. My brain was already punched up. They punched up. They don't punch down. So you make fun of the bad guys. They stick to that formula.
It's a very interesting time for you to be doing what you're doing. BYT also does this comedy festival, and it's called Benson Ball. And I feel like there's so much crossover.
There's a lot of
stand up and sketch and improv.
A lot of those guys like true crime, which is honestly what I count on, because I found out that Conan O'Brien is obsessed with Forensic Files. We all know that Bill Hader is our good friend of the show Bill Hader, probably calling in later, is obsessed with the Dateline and of course Keith Morrison. So what I try to like capitalize on is their interest in wanting to be part of that.
I liked the frivolity and the fun stuff at the festival, because without it you just want to cry.
Yeah, you need a palate cleanse. The formula of March was we had two shows a night. The first show was the serious show, and the later show was like usually the drunk, rowdy.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to go to both shows, and there are people that will come to everything, and God bless them, I rely on those people to keep me going. You need that palate cleanser. You don't want to end your night with the sad stuff.
Here's the thing. John Douglas, he was at your November 2018 festival and March 2019
Most handsome
festival.
Man.
I wouldn't go that far. I think it's fair to say that without him, we're not here today. He's sort of the catalyst.
He's the godfather.
He's the one that wrote Mindhunter.
My role changed. When I joined the FBI in 1970, a little naive, crime, justice, freedom for everyone, and I was really, really gung-ho. But as an FBI agent, I've never... could work on cases like these. We would get requests. I believe, Damon, you wrote a letter to my unit that I think you probably shit-canned at the time. It's like, here's another guy on death row, and they're all innocent. And it wasn't until, and I helped free some individuals while I was in the FBI, but it wasn't until after I got out, and I had defense attorneys coming to me, to look at the case, and sometimes I've had people encourage me, saying, "Oh, John, you got to really take a look at this case because this person is really innocent." And I said, "Oh, wait a minute, let me study the case, let me get the facts of the case, look at the medical examiner's reports and the investigative reports and go through things before I make that decision. And one of the first cases that I did and was highly criticized on was the JonBenet Ramsey case. And I've seen these shows, some of these shows on television. There's a major lawsuit that, as you know, CBS, where they pretty well fingered Bert Ramsey as the person responsible for the death of his sister, which is total garbage. But what I began to see there, and then later on in these cases here, it's this tunnel vision. It's an investigators who show up at a crime scene prejudged. They already have an idea in their mind as to who is responsible for these deaths.
You don't have Silence of the Lambs without John Douglas. That's why.
True.
You don't have Mindhunter. You don't have the entire part of the FBI that does this type of criminology.
True.
Now, it's impossible to say like that would have never happened, but John Douglas happened to be the guy that started it. Yes. Anyways, he was at the festival, and his shows were so incredibly well-informed because, like, worked for the FBI. He's essentially still sort of like a part-time PI.
Yeah.
He worked on the Knox case. He worked in the Eccles case.
He works on the show. He's a consultant on the Netflix show still.
And it's so both good, seeing, like, science can solve things, progress is being made, and depressing.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. Yeah. But it's like a really good educational TED Talk lecture without the frivolities.
Yeah, he sat in a chair alone in November in D.C. and spoke for over an hour, and nobody was bored. And honestly, you cannot say that about a lot of people.
No.
He just sat in a chair. He didn't move around. I mean, there's some visual aids, but
some
like
depressing visual aids.
I loved it. Oh, my goodness.
See, that's the thing. Like, you love that, and I'm just, like, so depressed. I don't want to do anything the rest of the day.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Where I read his books and I don't feel that way.
Well, maybe you're a visual learner.
Maybe.
This is how we discovered that. I don't know. There's something about it. I just think that the human brain, I think part of it, I don't know, let's take an even greater depressing turn, is like me having, like, not to brag, a mental illness. Ugh, I talk about it on the internet all the time. Get over it already. But for me, I'd like to learn about other people whose brains are broken. Not in the same way.
You want to feel less alone.
Yes, although I hate to be like, oh, boy, thank you, Dahmer. I feel great comfort now. But it is like a little bit of just like, wow, like look at what the human mind is capable of. Mm-hmm. How did this happen?
Yeah.
Why did this happen? And I'm not even interested in solving it. I just like, I don't know. I wish I could, like, whenever people ask me, I wish I could give an answer. I also think I'm just deeply morbid. I'm very, very morbid.
Yeah.
And I think that that's also an okay thing to say.
Like, yeah,
I don't like to find a higher reason. Like, oh, gosh, you know, one time when I was a kid, it's like, nah. I just really like dark shit.
Yeah, no, I don't. You're clearly not in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a weird thing in any way anymore.
But I think a lot of people try to attribute it because they feel guilty or ashamed of just kind of liking creepy stuff. So I sense that some people try to give it a greater meaning. Like, well, I really, and I'm like, not me, man. I want to look at. I want to look at crime scenes. I want to look at, like, I'm into it. I wish I could tell you why.
No, I understand. You interviewed, one of the pieces I'd like to point people to, I'll probably link it in this episode, is you interviewed the forensic expert? The person, the Maryland...
Oh, the Maryland Medical Examiner.
The American...
Maryland Medical Examiner.
Thank you.
We apparently, as I learned during that interview, have the best, or one of the best, if not the best, medical examiner's office in the country.
Yeah.
Which is depressing because it's in Baltimore.
And I'm bringing this up because I want to make it clear to the listener at home that, like, you're not just fetishizing and serial killers. You like all of it.
I do.
You're interested in all of it. You're interested.
I'm a real Renaissance gal. When
you're
it comes
not
to
like, oh,
crime.
I hope everyone gets away with it. I want more murders. No, you're fascinated by the actual crime solving aspect of this too. You're booking one of the people of the FBI for a reason.
Yeah.
You're booking experts for a reason. You're going to the medical examiner's office for a reason. I really enjoyed that piece. We'll link to
Thank
it
you.
Now. I feel like this is an impossible question, but I've been thinking about it quite a bit. I feel like we're on this cusp now of, it's no longer be like, I'm such a nerd, I like comic books. It's like, well, Marvel grosses the most money ever. You're not a nerd. You're not weird. You're the most mainstream thing possible.
How mad are they about that now?
So now, when you're like, oh, I'm weird, I like your crime, it's like, could you even say I'm weird? Could you even say I'm not normal? If the majority of things people are watching on Netflix are based in this.
Yeah, not anymore.
Is this even a niche?
There's probably...
Or is this essentially, like, is this on level of, like, turning on Sports Center on ESPN, you watching Forensic Files on HLN, it's like the same thing at this point.
I think like anything you could find, like there's broad interest in things like we all like, you know, Making a Murder, everyone freaked out, mm-hmm. and whatever.
Wild Love Country, the cult show.
The Staircase, etc. But then like I think there's always going to be weirder subsections of things. I guess you could still claim that you're like a creep.
But are
like,
you worried about that? Do you feel like you're going to lose your thing?
My thing, as in what's as in
well, true crime is like your thing. It's literally your job as a festival director.
No, because I.
Or are you happy? Is this good for you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't like complimenting myself, as you know. But I think that I have pretty creative ideas that not a lot of people can mimic or do on their own. And luckily, where we work, I am afforded these opportunities. To do these things, so you know, there's a lot of like, it's the perfect storm of things coming together. Yeah. That's what makes Death Becomes Us what it is. You know, we're allowed to do the weird stuff, and hopefully, everyone is on board with it.
It's a good way to end it. The weird stuff will be announced next week,
Monday,
ooh. And off mic, we'll talk about what you're actually excited for.
If you're interested in the Death Becomes Us Festival, go to brightestyoungthings.com. You're definitely going to want to go to brightestyoungthings.com this Monday for more information about the Fall 2019 Washington, D.C. edition of the Death Becomes Us Festival. Moving on, it's our chat with Nina O'Neill at the By the People / Monochrome Collective space. It's in Georgetown. Nina is a great talker. Nina is a huge champion of the D.C. arts. And if you are interested at all in local art, you'll want to stop by. It's free to stop by. It opens this Saturday and runs for 2 weeks. If you were interested in the Umbrella pop-up that happened about a month and a half ago, you're going to want to attend this. So here's Nina O'Neill and I, and come back to brightestyoungthings.com later this week for our preview of the festival. So how does Monochrome Collective mash up with By the People? How does that happen?
I started my business to match people and art.
Okay.
Period.
Yes.
Anybody who wants to buy art, I'm going to be the glue holding hands with both sides.
Mm-hmm.
By the People brings in internationally renowned, exceptional talent from the world. There's a lot of exceptional talent in the district.
Sure.
It's taking advantage of being able to show off the fine art with a capital F that folks who live and create in the district are making in a venue with folks that are coming in to see these international names.
Okay.
Putting those in the same sentence.
There are 50 pieces?
51 artists.
51 different artists.
51 different artists. As one of the artists pointed out to me, she's like, oh, you planned from the beginning for a DC thing. And I'm like, no, I didn't. But yes, I did.
Nice.
So I've totally taken credit for that. Great idea. 51 artists, over 150 pieces.
And how many are from the district proper?
They all are from the...
The DMV area.
DMV area.
Yes.
We have artists from Baltimore. We found artists that really consider home base to be DC, so we didn't venture beyond that.
And some of these are established artists that if you've gone to a Corcoran event or if you've gone to Umbrella, you've seen it. Some of them, this is their first time showing in DC?
What we tried really hard to do with the application process was not to list where you've shown, where you went to art school, what your art career is. The rule was if you make art, you're an artist, period.
Yeah.
So the beauty of the breadth of work that we have is that it's some people that literally create in their living rooms and some folks who have studio space and are in museum collections.
The prices seem reasonable.
I think they are.
They start at what? I haven't looked for the cheapest.
We said nobody's offended. We said that the range is $500 to $10,000 approximately. There's a little bit on either side of that.
Okay.
But everything's an original or part of a very limited series.
Yes.
So we wanted to be able to offer in a room exceptional, beautiful, fine art pieces that are made by a human being with skills, maybe that you don't have, that you can buy and support them.
I'm making very little eye contact with you, and I apologize. This room that we're in a back room.
Yes.
So for the listener at home, this is essentially two separate spaces.
Yeah.
A giant one right off of Wisconsin Avenue, in the heart of Georgetown, down the street from the Apple Store.
Yep.
So you know where it is. And then the other room is just kind of like, not hidden, but quieter. It's the blue-ish tone of a wall. But there's this one piece that I've been staring at, this Nara Park piece, Traces 2, and I really want to buy it.
Yes.
And it looks like it's going to be an impossible thing to dust.
Art conservation is a tricky beast. Okay. We can get into some unconventional materials. But,
so what am I looking at?
What you're looking at is, how do I describe this? It is a piece that is constructed out of polystyrene balls, very tiny ones, that are all different colors to create some geometric shapes. It's got life and texture and movement, and when it's properly lit, you see just like valleys and crevices, and it looks like a topographical map of an alien world.
Now, did you know about Nara before this?
I've seen her work before. A lot of these artists, I've seen their work before, but that's because I do this.
Yes.
And I'm very excited to be able to show work to people. I'm pleasantly surprised that there's a lot of people that we don't know their work. So, it surprises for me and surprises for a lot of people.
Yeah. So if you're someone like me, you're interested in the scene, but you maybe know like five names at most, this is a really good introduction piece. So if you saw Umbrella coverage and you're like, I wish I was at Umbrella. I'm looking at a piece now of an artist that was at Umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can actually come and buy that piece.
Yep.
It's not up for a weekend. It's up for a little bit longer.
Very true. What we were trying to do also, when you mentioned this backspace, what I was trying to do when designing the space is create, give the artists the real sense of being in a formal gallery setting. So the front space feels like it's an open hang. There's a little space for the artwork to breathe. It feels open and elegant and really well organized. If anybody who's listening has ever been to an art fair, it's the back room, the back closet, the back space that's just chock-block full of stuff. We have created that element by having a lot of artwork kind of more tightly hung in the back area.
Yeah.
So you see a lot more variety. Nobody likes stagnant retail. We're really treating ourselves like a shop.
Okay.
So as things sell, people take their work home.
Oh, that's great.
We're rotating through. So we're giving visitors the opportunity to want to come back.
Will an artist have an opportunity to put a new piece up once it sells?
We have a lot in backstock
already.
Oh,
that's great.
So we're going to rotate and keep moving. So when you come back through, the funny thing is there's a bus stop right outside.
Yes.
And I can tell you that most of those people are like, we can't wait to have a reason to look at something while we're waiting here. So we want those people, we want the neighborhood to want to come back over and over and, oh, I missed that. Oh, I didn't see it.
Could you talk about the origin of the physical space that we're in, how this came to by the people?
Sure.
Okay.
So by the people, Halcyon's an exceptional organization, really doing wonderful work in arts and entrepreneurship in the area, and they are based in Georgetown.
Yes.
And have become very friendly with their neighbors. And so when this came up, there was no better place than Georgetown to be able to house something beautiful like this. And we've been very fortunate to have worked with very generous people who are just excited to be able to show something like this in a temporary basis.
Yeah.
In a great location in Georgetown.
We're in the midst of this BYT Art Census where we're talking to people like you, we're talking to artists, we're talking about the scene as a whole. And when it comes to the visual arts, when it comes to like physical things you could hold, it seems like it's a really difficult thing to wrap your mind around unless you're part of it. So like, I don't know how you meet people. I don't know how you find new artists. I don't know how the process goes. All I know is occasionally I like to see the thing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I always wonder is, why aren't you guys being curators, et cetera, why aren't you being hired by people like Long and Foster? I'm just looking at a real estate sign.
Yeah, sure.
to use vacant and or temporary spaces to do things like this. Because if anything, this is a great ad for the neighborhood.
Ladies and gentlemen of Long and Foster, if you're listening, please bring us in. I mean, it's just, we're hoping that other folks will come through and be like, whoa, we're not making rent this month because we don't have a tenant.
Yeah.
But we've got a great location and we love what the arts community in DC is doing. Here's something I'd like to offer you. We're really hoping this is the first of many opportunities to be able to just showcase good stuff.
It's a wonderful space and it opens on Saturday, June 8th, and it goes until?
It goes till the 23rd of June, daily from 12 to 7, on the weekends 10 to 7. All of those hours, I will be here. Please come say hi and bring me a coffee.
Thank you so much.